Iran's leader issues his message through the Hajj pilgrimage, calling on Muslims to practically act upon his teachings, including unity. Russia's president says that he ordered his forces to avoid bloodshed during the recent armed mutiny, adding that enemies wanted Russians to kill each other. And Britain's cost of living crisis takes its toll on kids and youngsters, as a record number of them seek help for mental problems. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the Hajj pilgrimage can result in the spiritual and the moral elevation of all mankind. In a message on the occasion of the annual Hajj rituals, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Hajj is a microcosm of the diverse population of the Muslim world and helps bring security for all human beings. The leader said Hajj can also foil plots by hegemonic powers and Zionist entities to promote moral decadence in human communities. For the Hajj rituals to have a global influence, Ayatollah Khamenei urged Muslims to practically act upon his teachings, such as unity and spirituality. The leader said unity means closer bonds, trust, and cooperation between Islamic countries, and standing up to the common enemy. Ayatollah Khamenei added that unity also means thwarting enemy plots to pit Muslim nations against one another. He then urged political and cultural elites in Islamic countries to act in coordination for a new world order lying ahead. Muslim pilgrims are converging on Mount Arafat in Saudi Arabia as part of the annual Hajj ritual. The pilgrims are marking the day of Arafah, one of the high points of the Hajj pilgrimage. They're expected to use the day for prayers, as Muslims believe that God the Almighty forgives all their sins on this day. The hill of Arafat is also known as Jabal al-Rahmah. That means Mountain of Mercy, where the Prophet Muhammad delivered his final sermon, calling for equality and unity among Muslims. More than 2.5 million pilgrims are performing Hajj this year after Saudi Arabia removed all COVID-related restrictions for the first time since the year 2019.
The anticipation for the Muslims who have converged on the holy city of Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage is almost over. For the past few weeks, they have been arriving to the city and preparing themselves physically and spiritually.
We've come here to perform tawaf around the house of God, and it's right before we leave for Arafat, and it's a good feeling. I hope everyone experiences this.
They come from different countries and speak different languages, but they all have one thing in common, and that is that they are worshiping one God, each in their own way. The annual pilgrimage of Hajj is a mandatory religious duty for Muslims that must be carried out at least once in a lifetime, given they are physically and financially capable of doing so. But limitations could make the wait quite long.
I waited a lot of years so that one day I could come here to pray, and right now I'm very happy.
But for the ones that have made it, it's a dream journey. They make the most out of every moment by praying and repenting before God. But for many Muslims back in their countries, the wait goes on.
The rituals of Hajj take place in and around Mecca and will last 5 days. All the pilgrims that are taking part in this ceremony hope to go back home a better person before they get into the hustle and bustle of their everyday lives. Lahit Tahami, Mecca.
We've talked to academic and political analyst Hakime Sagayebiri about the significance of the Hajj pilgrimage against the backdrop of a new emerging world order. She says the Hajj teaches all human beings, not only Muslims, to move toward a world based on equality and justice.
The Hajj has been there for the whole of humanity. It has been there before Islam, and Islam brought more significance to the issue of Hajj and to, you know, this pilgrimage, and gave it life, basically. So it has a message for the whole of humanity, and that is why you see that different human communities around the world that are interested in justice and are interested in achieving equality and a just way of living on this earth are attracted to the Hajj pilgrimage. And that is why in some of the words of Ayatollah Khamenei about the Hajj in this year, we saw that he mentioned the significance of Hajj for the coming world order, that in the new world order, we could actually get a lot of lessons from this pilgrimage, that how the human world should be organized. It should get beyond all those different hierarchical ways of looking at humanity, that, you know, some human beings are superior to others and some human beings have the right to basically exert their own will and interests on everyone else. In the next world order, in the world order that is to come, we should, as human beings, and especially Muslims, should take the agency and take the initiative and take lessons from the Hajj.
The Russian president has spoken for the first time since an armed mutiny was aborted in his country. He says that enemies wanted Russians to turn their guns on each other.
It was precisely this outcome, a fratricide, that the enemies of Russia wanted, the neo-Nazis in Kyiv and their Western patrons, and also some nationalist traitors. They wanted Russian soldiers to kill each other, so that servicemen and civilians would die, so that in the end Russia would lose and our society would split, choking bloody civil strife.
Putin said that he had given an order to avoid bloodshed, adding that the revolt left Russia united. He called the rebellion a revenge for Ukraine's failed counteroffensive. The Russian leader said even if the Wagner private military group had not stood down, the revolt would have been suppressed anyway. He warned that any blackmail is doomed to fail. The Russian leader stressed that organizers of the rebellion would be brought to justice. Putin also met with Russian security officials, thanking them for their work during the revolt. The rebellion was launched by the Wagner Group after a long-running dispute with the Defense Ministry over the war in Ukraine. It was called off in less than 24 hours following a Belarusian brokered agreement between Wagner and Moscow. Earlier, we were joined by Russian journalist Esha Krishnaswamy from Mariupol. Here's her take on Vladimir Putin's response to the revolt by the Wagner paramilitary group.
I think he handled it in a very methodical process. Because, as we all know, things could have gotten out of hand, and instead of just maybe 12 or 15 people dying, there could have been hundreds or thousands. And so I think we also, it is good that they were able to broker a deal. And one thing that is different is that I heard from President Lukashenko that the Russian government will not pursue charges, but then now President Putin says that he plans on bringing the organizers to justice. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy, which we need to see how it'll play out and what exactly the deal that was brokered was.
Same with Russia. The country's Federal Security Service says it has dropped charges against members of the Wagner mercenary group, which launched a rebellion last week. The FSB, in a statement, said the criminal case opened over the group's armed mutiny has been closed. The announcement came after chief of the mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, declared that he would step down and ordered his men to stop their march toward Moscow. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has said that the failed armed mutiny has not shaken President Vladimir Putin's position. New figures from Britain's National Health Service show the cost of living crisis in the country has taken a heavy toll on the mental health of children and youngsters. According to the data, a record 1.4 million under-18s sought help for mental problems in 2022. That was the second year in a row the referrals beat the 1 million mark. Authorities say that mental issues among school-aged children have undergone an explosion since 2019, partially due to the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, the Young Minds charity, which has analyzed and reported the NHS data, says its own numbers show young people are facing a unique combination of challenges, mostly due to worries about money. The UK and many other Western countries face record inflation figures, mainly triggered by the Ukraine war and sanctions on Russia, which has led to major disruptions to global energy and food supplies. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in London, Rob Carter, to get a clearer picture of the mental health crisis affecting children in Britain.
The fact of the matter is that I think many are surprised about how widespread it is, particularly among such a young section of British society. I mean, it's very alarming that separate data collected by the same charity show that the main reason that parents are calling in to their helpline to try and receive some support for their for the concerns they have for their own children include things such as their child struggling with anxiety, self-harm, anger or aggression issues, problems with school, including refusing to attend at all. It is a massive crisis of its own accord. I think the focus has been on, say, the economic crisis or the crisis of oil costs. But there's very little focus on the crisis within mental health. As the charity also mentioned, a lot of their cases get blocked by the NHS because they're just not deemed to be serious enough. So I think that there's an ignorance about mental health, there's a lack of understanding, a lack of wanting to take it seriously, even by the government, who has been very slow to respond to this growing issue. And of course, the negative consequences of that will be felt in a kind of ripple effect, as many of these kids will turn towards drugs, they might turn towards crime, they won't have opportunities in the future because of a lack of education, because of anxiety issues. That could push them towards, I don't know, perhaps ending up on the streets, which will add to the homelessness crisis. This is the ripple effect that it can have.
The economy remains at the center of friction between China and the West. The Chinese Prime Minister has taken a swipe at the U.S. and the EU for their economic policies towards this country.
In the West, some people are hyping up what is called cutting reliance and de-risking. These two concepts are a false proposition because the development of economic globalization is such that the world economy has become a common entity in which you and I are both intermingled.
These remarks come as the European Commission outlined its approach toward Beijing last week. The approach revolves around de-risking and aims to reduce dependence on China in critical technologies. The U.S. has also adopted a similar stance, with President Joe Biden taking a hard line on Beijing. He has barred American companies from exporting high-tech semiconductors to China. Despite Western measures, the Chinese economy keeps growing. The Chinese government says the country is on track in reaching its annual economic growth target of around 5%. Insecurity remains a big challenge for the Taliban rulers in Afghanistan, as violence has claimed many lives across the nation in nearly 2 years. The UN report suggests over 1,000 Afghan civilians have been killed in bombings and other attacks since the Taliban took over in 2021. A survey by the UN's mission to Afghanistan shows some 2,700 civilians were also wounded between August 2021 and May of this year. The majority of deaths, over 700, were caused by improvised explosive devices, including suicide bombings in public places such as mosques, education centers, and markets. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed the majority of the attacks. This comes despite the claim by the Taliban that it has been conducting operations to ensure security. As Muslims around the world are preparing to celebrate Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, many Afghans are struggling to afford basic necessities amid an economic crisis and Western sanctions. Our correspondent Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
Eid al-Adha is one of the most important festivals in Islam, commemorating the willingness of Prophet Ibrahim to sacrifice his son for God. Traditionally, Afghan Muslims mark the occasion by slaughtering an animal, such as a sheep, goat, or cow, and sharing the meat with their family, friends, and the poor. But for many Afghans, this year's celebration is overshadowed by economic hardships and sanctions.
This has been my job for almost 20 years. I bring cows, sheep, and other livestock here. This aid, the demands are very low compared to previous ones. People come to check the prices, but they can't afford to buy. I have brought 30 sheep, but none is sold so far. I am counting on 8-day sales.
The impact of the economic crisis and sanctions on the Eid al-Adha preparation is also evident in Kabul bazaars and on the streets. People said that sales were low in most Kabul markets, as families were not able to afford aid necessities.
As you see, this aid, people are running out of money. They've been grappling with poverty and unemployment. It goes without saying that sales are low. In the past years, people have been taking great preparations for aid. They used to buy new clothes, gifts, sweets and nuts, but now they have opted to buy cheap alternatives or skip some rituals.
Despite the challenges, some Afghans are trying to keep their spirits up and celebrate Eid al-Adha with dignity and hope. They say they still find joy in their Islamic and national traditions.
Although Afghan people, especially women and girls, are going through tough situations, we want to seek joy in Eid and prepare for a celebration. We want to be happy and keep our spirits up. We came here for Eid shopping and it shows we are not losing hope.
Afghans are calling on the international community to lift the sanctions and resume relief aid that has been suspended or reduced since the Taliban takeover. As Afghans prepare for Eid al-Adha celebration, they are hoping for peace and prosperity in their war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The resistance movement Hamas has slammed the call by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to eliminate Palestinians' aspirations for statehood. Hamas says the comments show Israel's fascist nature. Hamas says the leadership of the Palestine Authority must reconsider futile negotiations with Israel and stop all forms of cooperation and security coordination with the regime. It also demanded that Arab countries boycott the regime and end all forms of normalization with it. The resistance movement also urged the UN and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation to condemn such Israeli positions. Hamas said those stances not only violate the most basic human rights, but also pose a threat to peace and security in the region. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent state with East outlets as its capital. The Israeli regime, however, lays claim to the entire city to call its capital. And finally to Sudan, where the paramilitary rapid support forces have announced a unilateral truce during the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. The RSF commander, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, said the truce will be effective on Tuesday and Wednesday. The announcement came as the army confirmed that the RSF had taken a well-equipped police base in the capital, Khartoum. There are also reports of fighting spreading for the first time to Blue Nile State near Ethiopia. Fighting has increased since a series of ceasefire deals failed to stick. The power struggle that broke out between the army and the RSF in mid-April has killed thousands of people. It has also caused a humanitarian crisis and displaced 2.5 million people. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Palestine became top issue in Islamic world due to Imam Khomeini and Islamic Revolution. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, on June 4, 2023, on the occasion of 34th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's demise. Our problems should not weaken people's hope. If we see problems, we should become more motivated to find ways to overcome these problems. We need to help those who are standing up against these problems and those that are trying to solve them. Of course, we have problems, but in return, we have phenomena that are promising. I would like to tell our dear young people that the enemy does not want us to see these promising phenomena. The promising phenomena are far greater than our problems. We have made progress in the fields of science and technology, in the growth of industrial and agricultural infrastructure, in the creation of very important transportation structures, in workforce training, in bringing construction activities to Iran's deprived and remote areas. We have made progress in international politics, in national honor, and we have also had developments in the country's military and defense power. These are promising facts that the enemy wants us to forget. It does not want the Iranian youth to know about them. These facts point to a brighter future.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When you speak about hope, some people try to ruin the hopefulness by mentioning these problems. If you speak about hope, they say you don't know about the realities. How can someone be unaware of the realities? These realities that they talk about are the realities of our economic and livelihood issues. Everyone knows these things and everyone is suffering from them. There is no doubt about it. Some people try to damage the hope in the hearts of our people by pointing out that there are people in different social levels who are not concerned with religion, faith, and the revolution. Well, yes, this is nothing new. Even in the 1980s, when our battlefields were filled with our religious youth, there were also some people in big cities like Tehran who would walk about carelessly and in a carefree manner. Not only did they not feel responsible, but they mocked the country's officials as well. If you read the biographies of our martyrs and soldiers, you can see how devastated they felt because of this, especially in big cities.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The situation was tense on Saturday between Russia and Wagner, a mercenary group fighting alongside the country's military in the Ukraine war. The tensions all started late Friday after head of Wagner Group ordered what he called a march for justice against the evil of the military. Yevgeny Prigozhin vowed to topple Russian military leaders. In an instant reaction, the Russian Defense Ministry said Wagner fighters have been deceived into an armed rebellion by the group's chief. The ministry said Prigozhin has dragged members of the mercenary group into a criminal adventure. It urged Wagner fighters to return to their bases, saying it will guarantee their safety. Russia then declared an anti-terror operation in and around the capital, Moscow. The Kremlin called for Prigozhin's arrest and opened a criminal case against him amid the ongoing rebellion. The comments came after Wagner's chief said his forces had entered Russia from Ukraine and gained control of a military site in the city of Rostov-on-Don. The move drew a strong reaction from the Russian president. In a televised address, Vladimir Putin said his country was facing treason.
We will not let this happen again. We will protect both our people and our statehood from any threats, including internal betrayal. And what we're facing is precisely betrayal. Excessive ambitions, invested interests have led to treason, betrayal of the country, its people, and the cause for which the soldiers and commanders of the Wagner Group had fought and died side by side with their other units.
Putin said Moscow will give a harsh response to traitors.
I repeat, any internal turmoil is a mortal threat to our statehood, to us as a nation. This is a blow to Russia, to our people. The actions we will take to protect our homeland from such a threat will be harsh. All those who consciously chose the path of betrayal, who prepared an armed mutiny, who chose the path of blackmail and terrorism, will suffer an inevitable punishment, will answer both before the law and our people.
The Russian president said the armed rebellion staged by the Wagner mercenary group was, quote, a step in the back to Russia. He called the mutiny a deadly threat to Moscow and said his country would defend its citizens against all threats. Putin underlined that those who seek to create chaos. Yevgeny Prigozhin said President Vladimir Putin was deeply mistaken in calling rebelling Wagner fighters traitors and ruled out surrender. He added nobody plans to turn themselves in at the request of the president or anybody else. As tensions escalated between Russia and Wagner, head of the mercenary group denied calling for a coup. Yevgeny Prigozhin said he was reacting to military strikes that allegedly killed 2,000 of his forces. But what is Wagner and what has it done so far? The group, officially known as PMC Wagner, is a Russian paramilitary organization founded by Prigozhin and has been operational since 2014. Wagner is seen as a private military company, a network of mercenaries, or a de facto private army of Russian President Vladimir Putin's former close ally, Yevgeny Prigozhin. The group operated in support of Russian interests and received equipment from the Russian Ministry of Defense. While the Wagner group itself was not ideologically driven, various elements of Wagner have been linked to neo-Nazism and far-right extremism. Wagner recruited its soldiers from Russian prisons in exchange for their amnesty. The organization spearheaded Russia's battles in eastern Ukraine while being at the forefront of the months-long assault for Bakhmut, capturing the city for Russia at huge losses. The group has been active in so many other countries around the globe, but has always denied involvement. In Syria, the presence of the mercenary group was first reported in October 2015, almost a month after the government in Damascus asked for Russia's help to fight against the Daesh terror group. Wagner was notably involved in both Palmyra offensives in 2016 and 2017, as well as the Russian army anti-terror operation in central Syria in the summer of 2017 and the Battle of Deir ez-Zor in the same year. Again in 2017, there were reports that Wagner was present in South Sudan and possibly Libya. However, those countries are not the only African nations that Wagner has had a military presence. Central African Republic, Madagascar, Mozambique, Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad are just to name a few. There are reports that Wagner has also had its military activities in Moldova, Serbia, Venezuela, and some other countries around the globe. To the Wagner's rebellion against President Putin, the mercenary group decided to take back forces to its bases following a one-day military escalation. But the mutiny marked the most serious challenge to President Putin's rule and Russia's most serious security crisis since 1999 when he came to power.
Thank you.
The U.S. is reinforcing its illegal occupation in Syria. That's according to the Russian president's special envoy for Syria. He said the U.S. is strengthening its military contingent in northeastern Syria, as well as in Al-Tanf, adding that the U.S. occupation forces in Syria continue to coordinate with terrorist organizations with the intention of carrying out more acts of terrorism in the region. This Russian announcement may be directly related to the U.S. military deployment of F-22 fighter jets to the West Asia region. The U.S. has cited increasingly unsafe and unprofessional behavior by Russian aircraft in the region, and this dogfighting is what the U.S. is accusing the Russian military of doing. According to the U.S., on several instances, Russian pilots tried to dogfight U.S. jets over Syria. The U.S. says the Russian pilots did not appear to be trying to shoot down American jets, but they may be provoking the U.S. in order to draw it into an international incident. It's hard, if not impossible, to sympathize with the U.S. After all, the U.S. has provoked Chinese Air Force in the South China Sea, including its Navy. Furthermore, the U.S., simply put, is in Syria illegally, and it insists it will stay there indefinitely.
My understanding is that the mission continues in Syria.
Breaking down the Russian accusations, first on U.S. training terrorists. This accusation has been repeated many times ever since the war on Syria broke out by the U.S. These two sources reveal in what ways the U.S. uses these terrorists along with the different objectives. One indicates the U.S. instructs the terrorists to target the Syrian government forces, while the other accuses the U.S. of using them to target Russia. The U.S. has time and again stated that their mission in Syria is to kill the Daesh terrorists.
The focus here is, from a United States standpoint, on ensuring that terrorist organizations like ISIS cannot reconstitute. We've obviously made a lot of progress toward that end since they first originated, you know, en masse back in 2014, and we don't want to see that progress be wasted.
U.S.'s stated goal, however, stands on a very weak footing. On the one hand, the U.S. is stealing and selling Syria's oil. These scenes took place in Syria's northeastern province of Hasaka. Convoys of tanker trucks seen shipping oil from Syria's oil-rich areas to U.S. military bases in neighboring Iraq. The Syrian oil ministry said the U.S. and its mercenaries are stealing an average of 66,000 barrels of oil per day. But why is the U.S. stealing Syrian oil and siphoning it to Iraq? Two reasons, Israel and Iran. Both Israel and the U.S. have acted against Iran in Syria, even though Iran is there in the capacity of military advisors at the invitation of the Syrian government. The U.S. has accused Iran of attacking U.S. forces in Syria.
To underscore, in response to a pattern of Iranian and Iran-backed attacks against U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq and Syria, and the continuing threat of future such attacks, the United States has taken, and as necessary, will continue to take military action against the IRGC and its affiliates.
The U.S. president has even ordered strikes against what it calls Iran-backed forces, retaliation to an attack that killed an American contractor while wounding five U.S. troops.
U.S. military forces carried out a series of airstrikes in Syria, targeting those responsible for attacking our personnel.
Iran has flatly rejected the U.S. accusation. Now comes the Israeli factor. There's a strong possibility that the U.S. presence in northern Syria may have to do with Israel, who has continuously attacked Syria throughout the past years. Israel has targeted Syrian and Iranian targets repeatedly, killing and assassinating Syrian government forces, including Iranian military advisors. Russia is now stepping up to the plate and confronting the U.S. Air Force while providing aerial support to Syrian government forces against foreign-backed terrorists. This may be indicative of a new conflict, however, erupting between Russia and the U.S. in Syria, in addition to U.S.'s proxy war against Russia in Ukraine. The
United States is facing a housing crisis. According to some reports, there aren't enough homes in the U.S. The most recent estimates from the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, commonly known as Freddie Mac, the country is short about 3.8 million units of housing. That means that there aren't enough homes to keep up with the number of new households that are forming. Elevated mortgage rates, which have doubled since early last year, have constrained home buyers' purchasing power. Instability in the banking sector, uncertainties about possible layoffs, and growing recession risks are also causing prospective home buyers to hold back. Homelessness crisis is particularly severe in the state of California. According to a new study by the University of California, over 171,000 people are homeless in the rich western state. California is home to 12% of the nation's population, 30% of the nation's homeless population, and half the nation's unsheltered population.
People really need the ability to pay their rent. When we ask people what would have kept them from being homeless, actually relatively small amounts of money. Over 8 in 10 said had they received one time $5,000 to $10,000 to catch up on their rent, to pay first and last month's mortgage so that they could continue paying, you know, a new apartment, they would have never become homeless.
It says the homeless population there is aging as nearly half of the surveyed adults were over 50 or older. It also reveals that homelessness is more prevalent among California's residents of color and minority groups. Furthermore, nearly half of the homeless surveyed in the research reported an inability to work due to age, health, or disability. More than 1 million people experience homelessness in the U.S. in a given year, and many more are at risk of losing their homes, though the actual figure is widely believed to be considerably higher. Florida, New York, and Washington also had high rates of homelessness last year.
California is emblematic of neoliberal U.S. empire with a liberal face around the world. California's economy is ranked among the top 10 in the world. If it was an independent nation, California would be among the 10 wealthiest countries in the world. Yet with that in mind, California also has some of the highest poverty rates in the United States, some of the highest homelessness rates in the United States, and some of the highest rates of inequality. The rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer.
Despite positive signs about a potential economic improvement in the U.S. economy, experts are still worried about a possible recession in the country. Over the past 15 months, the U.S. Federal Reserve has tried to tame inflation. It has raised interest rates above 5% in an attempt to get price increases back down to a more normal pace. Less expensive gas and slower grocery price adjustments have helped overall inflation to fall from its four-decade peak last summer. But experts warn the battle is not yet over because food and fuel costs tend to jump around a lot. Furthermore, experts believe the Fed may need to do more to cool growth and to rein in demand to prevent unusually elevated price increases from becoming permanent. Concerns are also rising about a possible recession in the U.S. Some experts believe the U.S. may avoid a recession, but the fact that big economies like the EU and Germany are now experiencing a recession are bad signs for the U.S. economy. The slower economic growth rate in China may also pull the U.S. into trouble. China's central bank this month started trimming major interest rates to support growth.
Manufacturing is already probably in recession, but I'm not sure exactly what sector of employment is going to pull back. But I do think that is the linchpin. And in order to get a weaker economy, you have to get weaker employment. But I think that's going to come. And as I mentioned, unemployment claims, which is the best timely measure of labor markets, they've moved up already a fair amount, to about 260,000 up from maybe 180. Okay. And 180, and 300,000 is the recession level.
A possible recession could throw the lives of millions of ordinary Americans into crisis. Higher prices are also denting people's ability to satisfy their needs. In California, for example, food banks, which saw more families seeking help during the pandemic, are now serving more people every month as extra benefits started during the pandemic have come to an end. That is reducing benefits to 5.3 million Californians and prompting the statewide Food Banks Association.
There's no solution to this, really. This was a huge loss for our whole state, for the whole country, and food banks can't just simply come up with the replacement. We're struggling already with donations that are down from the height of the pandemic. It's not seen as so much of a crisis anymore.
To warn of a catastrophic hunger crisis this year, food banks have also expressed concern over the federal debt ceiling agreement, which imposes more work requirements on food aid recipients.
tensions are running high in Syria's occupied Golan Heights following clashes between Syrians and Israeli forces there. The clashes erupted after the Tel Aviv regime announced a plan to seize the agricultural land of Syrians on the occupied Golan Heights for construction work. The Tel Aviv regime is pushing to seize the land to allegedly install wind turbines there. Syria's foreign ministry has condemned the aggression, describing the incursion as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. Damascus has been calling it an inseparable part of Syria's territories. Israel occupied the Golan Heights in 1967 and annexed it years later, a move never recognized by the international community. Meanwhile, a UN statement has said the number of Israeli settlers in the occupied Golan Heights has surpassed that of the Syrian native population for the first time since 1967. Israeli policies and practices on the Golan isolate the population from their familial and cultural links to Syria and enforce integration into the Israeli economy and education system for lack of any alternative. Israel has vowed to eventually quadruple the Israeli settler population in the Golan Heights to around 100,000. There are plans to build new housing units in Katrin, Israel's main settlement in the area. On the eve of the 1967 war, the region contained an ethnically diverse population of just under 150,000 distributed amongst 163 villages. Calls have grown to put pressure on the Israeli regime to return the occupied territory to Syrians. Former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation in 2019 recognizing Israel's annexation of the territory, which was denounced by the rest of the international community. Meanwhile, Israel is pushing ahead with its expansionist policies in the occupied West Bank. Media reports quoting Israeli sources say Israeli authorities have tabled plans to approve the construction of 4,560 settler units in various areas of the West Bank. The plans were included on the agenda of an Israeli planning council. The Israeli regime has already authorized new settlement outposts and pledged to construct new units in the West Bank. The United Nations has on various occasions denounced Israel's settlement constructions. Earlier this week, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Tor Wennesland, said he was deeply concerned that Israel had decided to, quote, alter settlement planning procedures that have been in place since 1996. According to the statement, the move is expected to expedite settlement expansion. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has also urged the Israeli regime to halt and reverse its latest decisions on settlement activity in the occupied West Bank.
A statement we issued yesterday said that the Secretary General was deeply troubled by the decision by the Israeli government to amend settlement planning procedures. He was also deeply alarmed by the anticipated advancement next week of over 4,000 settlement housing units by Israeli planning authorities.
The European Union has also reiterated its opposition to Israeli colonial settlement construction in the occupied territories. Since taking office in January, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has approved the promotion of more than 7,000 new settler units. It also amended a law to clear the way for settlers to return to four settlements that had previously been evacuated.
The Secretary General reiterates that settlements are a flagrant violation of international law. They're a major obstacle to the realization of a viable two-state solution and a just, lasting, and comprehensive peace.
Emboldened by former President of the United States, Donald Trump, and his all-out support, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334. Palestinian resistance groups have called on the international community and the UN to take serious and urgent steps to stop Israel's Judaization and colonial projects in the occupied territories.
This is IRIB English Radio. WRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: والله لدنياكم هذه أهون في عيني من عراق خنزير في يد مجزوم.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "By Allah, this world of yours is more lowly in my view than the leftover bone of a pig in the hand of a leper."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, when we talk about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this living, breathing miracle of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that one of the aspects of this beautiful universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this fact that he used to help the needy. Now, of course, this is a very interesting aspect about Imam Ali alayhi salam, and we find that throughout his life, he was always helping the needy, he was helping the disenfranchised, and he was helping the downtrodden. This is, of course, something that we too
must inculcate in our daily practical lives. We need to try to find a way to be able to help the people that are needy, help the people that are oppressed, and help the people that need help around us. Now, this can be done first and foremost with the people that are in our family. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, we think about helping somebody on the other side of the world, but our own family members, you know, are in dire need of help. And so even when we find the actions of the blessed infallibles, the imams and the messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon them, they used to help their family members, and they used to also help their non-family members, they used to help their companions, and then so on and so forth. The circle of influence keeps on getting larger and wider. But it makes sense. If we don't help our, you know, kith and kin, then nobody else is going to, right? And so regardless, helping people, helping the needy, trying to, help those people that are in need, that need assistance and that need aid, is one of the very beautiful aspects of the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. To the extent where Imam Ali alayhi salam, via his persona, has also explained this action, but at the same time, via his words, he has explained this idea of helping other people and fulfilling the needs of those people that ask, and even fulfilling the needs of people who don't ask, right? So sometimes there are people who are in need, but they don't, verbally ask you for help, but you know that they're in need. That is also an individual that needs to be helped. It's interesting, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that, grant to whomever you please, and you will become his emir, his master, and ask your need from whomsoever you please, and you will become his prisoner. Be free of need from whomsoever you please, and you will become his equal. So yes, fulfilling the needs of other people is something that is recommended. We find that Imam Ali has done this his whole life. And on the other hand, we find that very rarely, if ever, do we run across an instance where Imam Ali alayhi salam has gone to another individual for their need, right, for a handout, or in a position where he was begging another individual. You never see this. Matter of fact, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam always had the upper hand, for lack of better terminology. He was always the one who was giving as much as he could, and he was always the one who was helping people in need. And so many of us across the world, we are able to help others, whether it's financially or with the position that we have or the job that we have. And so we must try to find ways to be able to help people. And of course, if for whatever reason, we are not financially strong enough or not wealthy enough that we can help other individuals in our life, of course, the most simplest form of charity is a smile. A very profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. أشهد أنك جاهدت في الله حق جهاده وعملت بكتابه واتبعت سنن نبيه.
I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book,
followed the way of life of his prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto him and used his discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember thee and invoke thee. Let me be in love with thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying thee. كل صبح وكل اشراق ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولا ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. We are talking to the Shias. Alhamdulillah, you know many, many examples. We are just highlighting some of these examples just to for ourselves to remember those examples and learn lessons in our own lives. When Ali was traveling from Medina to Basra with his army to deal with the rebels who had gathered in Basra, the Battle of Jamal, on the way the army stopped in a place called Rabza, and there was a caravan probably going or coming back from Hajj, I'm not sure, but they were passing by and they came to know that this is the army of Amir al-Mu'mineen. So they diverted the route, went there, they said, we would like to see him. They were blessed. They had the opportunity to see Ali. When they came, you know, Abdullah ibn Abbas, the cousin of Ali, and a very close companion of the Imam, he went to the tent of Imam to inform him that these people have come to see you. They would like to hear something from you. And Nahjul Balagha has that statement from Ali when he talked to them. Even Sheikh Mufid in Kitab al-Irshad also mentions that. But it's interesting when Abdullah ibn Abbas went into the tent of Ali, what did he see? Who was this? He was Khalifatul Muslimin. He was the head of the Muslim empire of the time. In a way, absolute, you know, ruler of the time. And what he sees, he saw Ali sitting down on the ground with one, you know, pair of the sandal whose strap was broken and Ali was stitching it again, mending it himself. Have you seen any ruler doing this? And even Abdullah ibn Abbas couldn't accept it. He looked at him and said, Ali, what are you doing? Now look at his argument. And they were very close. They were cousins, of course. He could say that, but others couldn't really talk to Amir al-Mu'mineen that way. And he says to Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, why are you using your time in this? Your time can be better served by reforming us. There are people waiting to see you. Ali was silent, didn't respond to Abdullah ibn Abbas' statement. He continued, he was doing what he was doing. Once he had mended that one pair of the sandal, he put it by the other. Then he looked at Abdullah ibn Abbas and he says, قومها أو عبد الله, what is the value of this? How much will you give me for this? And he says, ليس لها قيمة. It has no value. It's so old, worn out, and it's repaired now. You know, it has no value at all. And Amir al-Mu'minin says, still give it, you know, dirham figure, not dollar figure, to it. Tell me how much is this worth?